Hello, friends, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. Yes, it is hotter than Hades here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So I'm hoping wherever you are, you have access to a lake, to a swimming pool, somewhere cool where you can just get out of the heat and chill out a little bit. I just want you to know that I am sacrificing myself right now and sitting in my car in 100 degree heat because I love you guys very much and I love producing this podcast. And so here we go. Here's another incredible guest for you this week. And to be honest, you know, besides for just being an Olympic athlete, which would be one thing, he's also changing the world. And I think my guest is kind of an example of someone who sees the need or is in the right place at the right time and then takes an action that literally saves lives. I'm going to have him describe what he does and how he is in the world, but suffice it to say that this was a longer interview. I mean, I could have really literally talked to my guest, whose name, by the way, is Lubim Kogan, for a very long time. You know, he's doing the groovy work of helping others, which is, you know, always been a passion of mine. I love meeting people who are changing the world for others. But he's also just this incredible grace-filled presence. And he's funny, and he's smart, and he doesn't take no for an answer. And frankly, you know, he was telling me this miracle story, and then, oh, by the way, this miracle story. And I just thought, okay, I'm just gonna go with the flow because clearly I'm in the presence of a force of nature. I'm gonna have him tell you all about himself. And then after the credits, there's gonna be a little bit of an extended Easter egg for those of you who are interested. Yeah, the whole conversation from soup to nuts was pure beauty. And so let's get going. Here's my interview with Lubim Kogan.
You know, I think that day I put on more than 300 miles of driving around. And I was really exhausted. And I said, you know, I promised them that I will take them out. And this is one day I have to go. So I forced myself. It's like super cold. I'm driving. We go out. We have dinner. And we're driving back. And my corner of my eye sees a kid outside.
Introduce yourself. How do you self-describe?
I think this is the most difficult question that somebody can ask you as a guest because, I would say that I consider myself just a normal guy. I have a very difficult time living with my fears. So if something scares me, I really have to do that. I cannot just push it aside. And the other thing about me is that I am the person who could not look away. So if I see somebody who is weaker than me or somebody who is struggling, I cannot look away. I was going to say I have a difficult time looking away, but I cannot look away.
Thank you. I absolutely detest bullies. So that is something that I can't deal with and that pushes me over the edge. I wanted to ask, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the former Soviet Union in the 70s and the 80s. And when I was 5 years old, the Afghanistan war started and it lasted until I was 16. So the first part of my conscious life, that war was always on the background. And being a kid, you know, I was always athletic. And one thing that that I experienced was that the guys who came back from Afghanistan, they gave kids who tried to do sports unlimited support and unlimited amount of time. So every day when I was practicing my sports, there was somebody from, you know, the guys who are older. And normally, you know, when in the former Soviet Union, the military draft was mandatory. So at 18 years old, kids would get drafted. And when they would come back, if they came back physically uninjured, they were really strong, you know, they just were at the peak of their physical performance. And when you're a little kid trying to do some things, I noticed that they would spend a lot of time with us and give us a lot of attention. And what happened at the end of the day, they would all get drunk. And yeah, then the police would show up and they would start fighting. And one of the questions I had when I was growing up, and that took me 40 years to answer this question, and I finally got an answer this year, it was like, why were they like that? That was question number one. And the question number two was, why is the system that took them out of their home, you know, I think now I know that the 18-year-old, you're just a kid, why would they take them out and send them to fight wars to another countries? And then when they came back, not only the system did not support them, the system, in our case, was police would beat them up. And that was a big question that I carried with me throughout my life. Also, growing up in the former Soviet Union, I am the child of the Cold War. And my image of the United States was that the President Reagan is sitting in his office and he has this red button and he can go boom and we're all done. And when I was 17 years old, it was in 92, I immigrated to the United States. And I found out that it was not the truth. And I'm talking to people who are my generation, and they're saying, hey, we were thinking the same thing, that the Soviet is sitting there and he could hit the same red button and we'd be finished too. So, you know, the propaganda and the brainwashing, the machine that was trying to shape you into something, I experienced how it worked. And then when they made it across the ocean, I found out that it was a complete, you know, made up story.
And the propaganda continues just in general, all over the world, quite honestly. Yeah. It's the scope of it is kind of breathtaking and horrific. Well, you know, why did you all emigrate when you were 17? How mm-hmm. did that happen?
It's a really good question. So if we rewind, the Soviet Union broke up in 1991 and Ukraine became an independent country. And what happened was that it was a complete collapse in the economy. The currency had to change. It was a real time of hardship. So crime became really rampant. And the most profitable crime is racketeering. And basically, when somebody was, it was a last wave of major immigration. When somebody is leaving their country, they normally sell all their belongings, everything they've accumulated throughout their lifetime, and they're sitting on all the cash they saved for maybe generations. And what they have left are the most prized possessions. So there are a lot of stories of people who were going to leave and, you know, the bad guys just broke into their homes and just took everything that people accumulated. And there was an incident when my sister and I, we went to get some takeout food. I did not hear, she was younger than me. I did not hear what was said, but she came home and she told her parents, she said, look, we were getting food. And this guy said, hey, look, here are the kids of a millionaire. Now, for just to give you a background, in the former Soviet Union, private, like to be entrepreneur or have your own business was prohibited. It was punished by prison sentence. So was owning foreign currency. So was owning gold. So everybody, the 100% of population was expected to work and feed the machine. And when you could own your business, it started, you know, in the 90s with Gorbachev and Perestroika. My dad was one of the first people who started his own business. And the fact that you are just starting out and you don't necessarily have the money just because you were running the business, it was really easy to point fingers. And when he heard what was said, he took two of my younger sisters and my stepmom, and he sent them on vacation outside of the country. They left in April and they didn't come back all summer. In the fall, he came home and he said, Lubim, we're leaving. I said, when? He said, in about 3 or 4 hours. I said, where are we going? And he said, we're going to the United States. And I asked him for how long? And he said, forever. So I had 4 hours. Yeah, I had 4 hours to pack up and leave the life that I really enjoyed, you know, because I was 17 years old. I was a national team athlete, relatively popular. And, you know, everything was going great. But here we had to pick up and go. So I had this blue bag. I took my ski boots, my jumping suit, my helmet. I wore my training suit on the plane. And I remember that I didn't even have socks. And that's how I came to the United States.
I did not expect that answer.
Yes, like just like that.
God, I mean, I tell everyone that one of my greatest strengths is that I can pack for any amount of vacation in about 15 minutes. But how do you pack for the rest of your life? You know, not only that, but how do you leave a place where you have friends? It's been the only home you ever know. You know, you're very successful in school. You have friends, you are good in athletics, and then you have to go and start things over. And, you know, you were talking about fear earlier and how it's my understanding that you face it head on. Would you say that I'm correct?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of a mechanism that I have a connection, the fear and connection inside. And if it's about things that are important to me, then I really cannot not do it because I'm afraid. And as a matter of fact, it actually, with time, I learned that it's one of the signs that I really need to look into it. I'm not saying I'm like a mad person who does everything that scares me, but if I have a connection inside with something I want to learn and something I want to accomplish, something that I want to do, just the fact that it's scary is one of the signs that I really need to do it. And one of my friends said, Lubim, you are the kind of person who cannot live with his fears. He said, but for me, it's okay to go to the gym. I'm going to the gym.
Well, because, I mean, I think you do. Okay, so first of all, you have to know that I have an insane fear of heights. Like, I'm talking about, when I went to the Grand Canyon, I couldn't get too close to the edge because I have vertigo. And so I lose my balance. And so I really, you know, someone said, hey, don't you want to go up? It has a new name now, but growing up, the Sears Tower in Chicago, they've built this.
Yeah, Sears Tower. I know it is Sears Tower.
Yes. They built this thing where you could go outside where I think you can see through. Uh-huh. Okay. I couldn't, uh-huh. I would pass out or I would fall over. I can't do that, but you do some things that I just don't understand. And how do you do that?
Okay. So can I ask you this? Are you afraid of flying on the airplane?
Yes, of course. I hate airplanes.
You are?
Oh, yeah.
You are actually afraid of being on the airplane?
Well, there's multiple reasons I don't like airplanes. One, I'm claustrophobic. So the other thing is I just don't like people so close to me that I don't know. Like I have this thing where I just don't like, and in an airplane, you're surrounded by people you can't get away from. So there's that, the claustrophobia, there's the height because the airplane is up high, and then there's the loss of control. So there, all those.
Okay, so, you know, you are on the extreme spectrum of the fear of heights because I fly paragliders, and it's a little plastic bag that hangs over your head. You have little strings, right? And you're sitting in the backpack. There is no fuselage. There is no engine. And you're suspended thousands of feet above the air. I thought I had fear of heights until somebody explained to me, like, when you are high in the air, what can happen to you? Nothing. What can happen to you when you hit the ground is the point when it becomes dangerous. So what people are mostly afraid of is actually of falling out. And a lot of people who have fear of heights, I have claustrophobia too, and I don't like people close to me that I don't know. And I'm okay with releasing control to the pilot because I'm a pilot and I know that they know what they're doing. But a lot of people say that they have a fear of heights when in reality they have fear of falling out. And I had passengers that came out specifically to deal with this issue. So I do a lot of hand-holding, explaining, showing that you cannot, even if we go upside down, you cannot fall out. So one of the things, we don't go upside down, we don't do that. But if one of the things that you say that the fear is not of height, but the fear of falling. And when you said going to the edge, is that when your subconscious mind kicks in and says, stop, we are going to fall, you cannot go any further. So I hope my little therapy session is working.
Thank you. I actually, you know, I have not been on a plane in decades, and that's fine with me. But, you know, when I went to Europe and I walked the Camino and what was it, 2013, I loved it. I took a ship from Miami to Barcelona and then three trains to southern France, walked across France from south to north, and then walked across the Spanish coast. Never got to Santiago, took a ferry to Cornwall, spent 3 weeks in Cornwall, and then took the Queen Mary back to New York. And it was like the best trip ever. Wow. And but also, you know, there's a caveat. I'm a fan of slow travel. You know, I can't do, you know, when people say, oh, I went to, you know, Turks and Caicos for a week. I'm like, why? You don't learn anything. You know, I love to learn about a place. I love to actually meet people. I love to be there for months so that I can actually understand the space where I'm in. Plus I love museums. And so then, you know, I'm not conflicted between beach museums. So I just, the way my brain functions, it's just better for me to take an extended period of time to relax and sink in. Well, I want to ask you, just because I'm really intrigued by this question, what do you think, or do you consider the scariest thing, event, but like for paragliding, for me, if I ever did that, or bungee jumping, which I would never do, that would be the most terrifying thing. That if I did it, I would be like, I can't believe I did that. What do you consider to be maybe the scariest hobby or scariest thing that you've intentionally gone into and confronted?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Paragliding.
Oh, God.
First time. Let me tell you how it went. Excuse me. So it was 2016. And I was working for this company in Ukraine. And if you look back on when the war started in Ukraine, it started in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea. And we had such a dire situation that I couldn't take out salary because, you know, financially the company was stranded. And all the people knew that I love skiing. So everybody who worked in the company, they pitched in and they sent me skiing to Austria for Christmas. I'm walking into hotel to check in and I see this advertising, tandem paragliding. Say, okay, I do the paperwork, I get my key, I turn around, boom, another one, tandem paragliding. And I'm thinking, huh, I never saw one, and here there are two of them. So I take the brochure, I went up to my room, I didn't unpack anything. I just got the phone and I dialed the number. A lady answered, and I said, I want to fly. And said, okay, show up tomorrow. So I show up tomorrow at the top of the mountain. She's like, here's your pilot. And the guy, he was like in his 60s. He's really tall, really strong Austrian guy who's lived outside. He's like, okay, let's go. And we're walking towards the end of the cliff, it was a huge cliff. And he's saying, hey, is this your first time? I said, yes. And he says, it's mine too. it's the stupid joke that all the tandem pilots make. And no matter in the world where you go, they make this joke. I didn't think it was funny. Then we take off and I see the mountain and the ski hill is like disappearing. It just chairlift looked like this. And I thought, I'm going to die. I said goodbye. I started saying goodbye to my dad. I said goodbye to my brother. And then I said, okay, just, you know, Lubim, stop. He's going to land. And we landed. Kirsten, I was like this. The guy left, you know, he packed up his stuff, said bye. And he goes up the hill for another flight. And I'm sitting there and looking at my hands. I'm like my head is fine. Everything is fine. I'm on the ground. And I used to ski jump, right? That was my sport. And you go 60 miles an hour down the ramp. You head forward and you split your skis and you fly. I thought I was a relatively brave person, but like at the bottom of the hill, I was shaking and I was like, I have to learn how to do this thing because nothing ever scared me that much, that my conscious mind is completely relaxed, but my body is having this, you know, reaction, that red zone, like it's shaking. And then I started flying. And for the first 3 years, I would get to the takeoff and my heart was like, we were in Tenerife for the first time. I went with the French instructor and he's like, man, relax. Like, you know how to do this, just relax. But I couldn't. It took me 3 years or more until I understood what I was doing. And I felt like I got the control. I knew that anything is happening, I can cancel, you know, it's a skill to cancel your takeoff. And once I had the control of the glider and I knew no matter what's happening, I can handle this thing, then the boom, boom, boom went away. And yet it's still, you know, I still have it. So it's not like I'm completely at peace going to my refrigerator to get some water to drink. You know, it's not like that. It is still, it doesn't scare me like before, but I think going paragliding and learning how to fly, and then learning how to fly passengers, you know, that was another step, but that was definitely the scariest thing that I made myself do, I think. Yeah, it is.
Well, thank you, but thank you for also bringing up this. Now, you're talking about what you did when you would be on the ski ramp and you would fly off the ski ramp, because believe me, I have watched that sport and how high they get. And, you know, that actually doesn't scare me as much as paragliding, because if you have trained, you're in control. But okay. So you were in the Winter Olympics. Was this a sport mm-hmm. you did for the Winter Olympics?
Say it again, please. Was ski jumping the sport?
Yeah. Was ski jumping the sport?
Yeah. The ski jumping was my sport. That's the sport I competed in the Olympics in 98 in Nagano.
Okay. So how, like, I'm just curious, do they start you on a smaller ramp, like a baby ramp, and then they get you a bigger ramp, and then you finally get the ramp that's like the epic ramp that you use in the Olympics? How do you even train for that?
Okay, let me tell you how I started, because I think you would really appreciate that part. I dreamt about being a cyclist. I slept with my bike. I'm one of those kids who was like mad about it. And my dad, once I got to the point where we would go, like when you literally ride in the park or you ride in the neighborhood, but then you go out on the road, and we did have a follow, you know, the follow car with the coach. And my dad didn't really feel that it was safe. And he was right, because in the former Soviet Union, there were no shoulders and no really developed highways and roads. So he said, Lubim, you can do any sport but cycling. So I started ski jumping to prove him that he was wrong, that, you know, cycling is not that dangerous. I'm sure you didn't expect that, huh?
No. But I mean, I think it speaks to an incredible, well, you have to have an incredible belief in your capacity to do these difficult things, but also an incredible amount of bravery, because, you know, paragliding or jumping off a ski jump. I just... You know, when I was a kid, sometimes we'd build these ramps for our bikes and like pretend to go up in the air. And I actually did race cyclocross for 3 years.
Wow.
I was terrible. I was always in the beginning category, but I liked it because, you know, in my 40s, it helped me to feel like a kid again, if that makes any sense.
And
it
was, yeah.
Yeah, it was in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, they have one of the biggest ones in the country, and people would throw hot dogs at you while you're racing and donuts and hand you beers. So it wasn't like this serious endeavor at all. And I always came in last or close to last, but I was like, you know what? This is fun. I'm having fun. I would suspect that, even though you were training for the Olympics with the ski jump, was it still fun?
Oh, yeah. I love doing it. That's the only way I did it. And, you know, I loved it that much. Like I told you, when I was leaving when I was leaving for the United States, and I had a few hours to pack. I packed my ski suits, my boots, and my helmet because, you know, growing up during Cold War, I was thinking that President Reagan is sitting in his office and he can hit the red button and we're done, right? But when I had the opportunity to go, another thing that I knew was that Lake Placid, New York, had two Olympic Games, one in 1932 and one in 1980. And right after Soviet Union broke up, you know, it was the structure that was there, it disappeared. So they canceled all our training camps, all the competitions, and that the last year before going to the States, I couldn't ski. And when I had a chance to go, I knew about Lake Placid. So what am I doing? I am packing my stuff because I want to ski. And I love doing that so much that, you know, I tell people that when I came to the States, I had two dreams. One was mine and one was my father's. My father's dream was so I would go to a really good school, preferably business school. And my dream was to ski in the Olympics. When I got to New York, I got accepted to New York University. And I went down to New York City. I realized that if I wanted to ski jump, it would be a 600-mile commute every weekend. And I loved it that much. And for more than 2 years, every weekend, I commuted more than 600 miles. And when we had competitions, it was a lot more because the competitions were Vermont, New Hampshire, sometimes Maine is the furthest. And imagine then it's not a 600 mile trip, it's more. Studying on the bus, I gave up all my college experience. I don't know what's partying in college like because I would finish my class on Thursday and I would walk to my dorm, I would get my stuff and I would go to the bus station in New York. I take the bus to Albany, that's 150 miles. I would pick up my car and I would drive to the Adirondacks another 150 miles. And then I would come back, you know, for Monday classes. And I did that for 2 years. And I'd say that if somebody doesn't love doing, I loved it so much that I just wanted to go skiing. You know, I wanted to go do my things. And that trip was the requirement to get to enjoy and get to, you know, ski jump.
Well, let me ask, do you still ski jump?
Oh, no, I am heavy and slow. Last time I was, right. Relatively. For ski jumpers, I'm really slow and heavy. But last time I ski jumped, I think it was 2017, maybe. I went to the Masters World Championships, and it was a fun event. I saw a lot of friends, but I did it one time. But now, no, I just enjoy sitting in the air and just pulling little strings. And it's not that much effort. You know, it doesn't require so much physical conditioning.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's for the faint of heart. So I get that. Well, I want to ask you, my second question is, did you grow up in a religious household? And my listeners kind of love these stories because mm-hmm. you know, most people evolve. You know, they have this experience in their childhood, but then the definition of how they connect to whatever, you know, and I've had atheists on the show too. I've had every kind of person, every kind of belief system. So I'd love to hear your story about what mm-hmm. that looked like.
So in the former Soviet Union, religion was prohibited. Even though some churches were open, but all the synagogues were closed and converted to storages. And it was when I was 15, when the religion was making it into the country. And it was Karl Marx who said that religion is the opium for the masses. And that's how I was brought up. But I remember that I had a lot of grandparents, and they celebrated holidays behind closed windows, drawn shades, and the families would meet in the house. It was always quiet, you know, quiet gathering, having meals at the table at the important religious holidays. All the kids are there, adults are there, but it's not advertised. It was done behind the closed doors, and the shades were always drawn down. So I grew up in I wouldn't say that it was atheistic society. It was a society or country that controlled and prohibited religion. And after things changed, I was really curious. You know, I was really curious because when something like, imagine religion is prohibited, but then the walls go down and the missionaries started to come in. And the missionaries would come in for different religions and they would try to find young adults. I'm a teenager, you know, we're talking, I'm like 14, 15, 16. And I was really curious. And that's when it started. Now I am, I would say I'm a spiritual person. I don't really subscribe to any one religion, but I do believe that there is, you know, a higher power, that we were created and that we are all connected together. So if people pick different religions, it's personal preference and belief, but, you know, at the origin, you know, we have come from the same place and we go to the same place.
Well, you know, when you moved here, when your father moved you to the States, suddenly did your family join a religious tradition? Did they?
No, but I always had, you know, it's one of the supporting mechanisms that I had. Because first of all, I had a religious asylum when they came. The United States granted us religious asylum. We were the last echelon of people who could immigrate to the United States because religion was prosecuted. And, you know, then coming to the States, you are welcome and supported by religious organizations. And, you know, when I was going, making that commute to Lake Placid, our local synagogue, they always waited for me because they knew I'm alone. You know, I'm still a kid, 20 years old. And I would go to Lake Placid. I would go to synagogue, you know, after skiing, I would go to synagogue. They would feed me. They would send me home with food. So it was my support mechanism. And they really, I wanted to learn things and I wanted to find out. And as a matter of fact, my best friend was a rabbi. We were the same age. He had 5 kids. I had none. He lived in New York City. He had his own synagogue. And I lived in Colorado. And I think the reason we became close friends is because when somebody has questions or issues or they want to know the rules, they go to a rabbi. And a rabbi can go to his rabbi, but that's it. They cannot go to a friend or anybody. But because we were so completely opposite in terms of, you know, how we lived, we became really close friends. And he was an instrumental person when I was making big decisions, like leaving American Express and starting my own company. So I relied on that support when I was in the United States. I came close to a religion. Like, Orthodox didn't accept me because I didn't look like them. But yeah, but I don't know, you call it Reformed or Reform. They welcomed me and I felt really a part of that group. So on one side, I felt the exclusion. On the other side, I was accepted. And the cool thing about the United States is that we have that depth, you know? If you're looking for your place and you don't belong to this church or to this synagogue or to this group, there is always variations and a place for somebody to find a place where they would feel at home.
Yeah. Oh, that's really beautiful. And it's very true. And religious tolerance is, you know, when I said I get triggered by bullies, it includes people who hate or dislike whole swaths of people because of their religion. I just, you know, this country was founded on religious freedom. Let's live up to it and let's have a little more inclusion and tolerance just in general.
Kirsten, you know, like if you think about the First Amendment, you know, just not the freedom of speech, it's freedom of speech and religion. And it took me 20 years to realize how important it was. We were getting a reward in Hollywood for a book that became a national bestseller. And I'm standing on the red carpet and I'm thinking, first of all, if it wasn't for the First Amendment, I would never make it here. I would never get the religious asylum. And second of all, if my speech was not protected, I wouldn't be able to write about things that I want to write. So our Constitution blends both, right? And when people are trying to, when people have such harsh opinions, like you explain, or it's not harsh, probably rigid is a better word. Nah, it's a little bit extreme for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Okay, so excuse me, tell me how you ended up being on the Hollywood red carpet, which seems very stressful for me and maybe even scarier than going paragliding.
No, it really wasn't. You know, it was fun. And what happened before was scarier. I had a knee reconstruction surgery in 2014. And I wanted to, my goal was to ski that winter. You know, so happened if I do everything right and everything comes together that I can go skiing again. And I rehabbed so hard that I got, you know, my doctor said, for Halloween, you're showing up as Ken Clark. I was like, what? She says, yeah, you're Superman. You are showing up for Halloween as a Superman. And that became because, you know, when you have, after you have a surgery, you have to follow physical therapy protocol. And a lot of people don't have the patience and they cannot, they skip stuff. And they taught me, if you want to be a Superman, you don't try to run up the mountain in like 3 weeks. A real Superman follows the steps and then you have a probability of success. Now, it was, my surgery was July 1st, and now we are somewhere in October or November. Ski season is coming soon. I'm doing really well. And I was in the back seat of the car the night before we had to get the reward. And I just tried to get up and I pulled myself with my legs and I heard something pop and I had this pain. I couldn't walk up or down the stairs. I call my therapist and I say, look, I don't know what happened. I heard this huge pop. My leg is not working and I'm all freaking out, right? And she says, okay, you go get a cane and you got to walk with the cane. And when you come back home, I lived in Colorado. She said, we're going to see what happened, but you're walking with the cane. And when we came for the to receive the reward, I went up to their organizers and I said, look, I'm extremely uncomfortable. Can you please let me go in the first? Because there were a lot of people and I was probably somewhere at the end. And I said, I need to go because I have to leave. I went and I got my award. And it's a process, you know, you go get the thing and then you go backstage. That's where the red carpet, where they all stand with microphones and they interview you. So I put my cane down. I walked on the stage without the cane. I got the award. I got the cane and I go. And I'm standing on the red carpet. And I was not scared at that moment because I saw all the people being interviewed. And it really dawned at me at that moment the meaning of the United States Constitution and specifically the First Amendment, freedom of religion and freedom of speech. And I was like, wow, this is what this country was built on. And I am just an immigrant who followed his dreams and actually got to experience this. So I'm coming to this interviewer and she's asking me questions. And you know, when you're so overwhelmed with the realization, so it was from 92 to 2014, that's 22 years, right? And I realized what I did in 22 years. And I remember talking to her and her like jaw dropped and she's holding the microphone and she's looking at me and she's like, what? She didn't expect that answer. It totally blew her away. So, you know, that was my experience of being on the red carpet.
Well, rightfully so, because quite honestly, I mean, you have done so much. You've had this life that is almost like a superhero, and you've done things that are just utterly astonishing. And before we get to the, you know, the meaty part of the podcast, I'd love for you to talk about, you know, your journey to where you're doing Wings for Heroes, and how that came about for my listeners. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So perfect question, because 2014, I get the award for the national bestseller. The next year, I get invited to speak at the United Nations headquarters in New York City with Brian Tracy, who was the man who showed me how inadequate I was. And that happened when he sent his sales guy to sell tickets for his events at American Express. And that guy came in and what he did with the room, I've never seen anybody command people like that. And it fascinated me. So I followed him after, you know, after he did his presentation and he told me about Brian Tracy. And then I started buying his courses, learning how to speak, learning a lot of things. And it took more than a decade. And then I get an invitation to share the stage. After I finished that, I really thought I'm on top of the world and I'm going to monetize. I thought I'm going to print cash and I am set. But the same year, just a few months later, I ended up in Ukraine because my dad still lived there. And actually, I was there in 2014. And then this is the second time that I came. And I had an offer to do an internal audit for a big company. And when I finished my work, they actually asked me to stay on and, you know, lead it until things change, until they're not a failing company anymore. So one day, we are right now in 2016, I was at one of our gas stations by the highway, and I saw a double amputee roll out from our store in a wheelchair, and he went towards the highway. And I remember looking at that guy and thinking, where is he going? There is no pedestrian way. We couldn't walk. Forget about the wheelchair. And of course, like the story goes, I got busy with taking care of my things. And then it wasn't half hour later that a huge thunderstorm came. I mean, it's just like a wall of rain is coming. And I got one of our drivers, we got a pickup truck, and I said, we're going, you know, in that direction. And we found this guy on the side of the road. He was all splashed in mud and dirt. And I was like, nobody stopped, you know? So we go out, we get his chair, we put it in the back of our truck. We put the guy inside. And I don't know if you've ever met people, like, even if you clean a person up, you know that there's not much life left in them. And that was my close contact with another veteran almost 40 years later, and we have the same situation. They get taken out of their home, you know, they sacrifice their body, and then they're discarded. Another 6 years goes by, so I really thought that I should do something. And then another 6 years goes by, and now we're in year 2022 when the full-scale invasion started and the war escalated. And I saw this young girl, teenager. She walked out in front of a stadium full of people on her new prosthetic leg, and she said, they can take part of our country, and they can even take a part of my body, but they're not going to break me. That was the moment that I said, okay, I'm done thinking that I'm going to do something. I'm doing something. And that is the moment when Wings for Heroes, it's actually, I would say it was born. The decision was made on that spot. It took me another year and a half to find somebody, a hero to fly, but that's how it happened.
Thank you for sharing that. It is kind of astonishing how many people will drive by those who need help, those who need assistance. I don't know if it's, there are probably so many reasons why people ignore others who need help. And we can't go into all those right now, but so will you explain what Wings for Heroes does now?
Yes. I want to just say something before we go into that, because you said you cannot stand bullies, right? And I want to talk about what I see as the biggest threat that's facing Western societies, and that's apathy. That's the thing that everybody can, you know, you can have an old lady spill oranges in the middle of the road and people will be honking and she cannot go any faster. Or you can have somebody who is struggling, you know, without legs or arms and people will just go by. So the level of apathy that we have in our society, everybody's chasing their own God. Everybody's so concerned with making more money. And I'm saying, look, at some point, you're just adding comma 00, comma 00. There are no ones, you know, it's only zeros. It doesn't change your life. You're already comfortable. You can buy all you can. All your needs are taken care of for the fortunate ones, but they can't stop. And now after COVID, we've been separated. We were all divided and our life is like this. You can be in that room. I can be in this room. We can pay each other for doing businesses. Then we can order food. They'll bring it to us. Clothing, medicine, everything. We don't need to go anywhere. And the level of apathy, we're losing that human connection. So when I get a chance to speak to somebody like you who actually decides, look, I am going to create space for people who believe into something because it's important for us to come together. And the level of apathy we're facing right now, we are in the most dangerous period in the history of this world. Because for the first time in history, a nation that has nuclear weapon is using that. They're redrawing maps, and it's a nuclear blackmail, and nobody is talking about it. That's how much apathy has changed our world. We are threatened to our existence, and yet we can look away. That, I am talking about it right now, but I remember being at NYU in the 90s, and we had to take classes outside of business school. At that time, I didn't know why. Now I'm kind of starting to understand. But in the sociology class, we studied this famous case from New York City where a young lady was being raped and she was screaming for help. She actually was killed. She died. The guy was raping her. A lot of people were turning on the lights and somebody yelled out of the window, hey, I'm calling the police, like, leave her alone. The guy left, he came back. The next day when police was questioning all the people, more than 30 people said, yes, we heard it. And there were more than 100 people. 30 admitted that they heard it. And they asked, why didn't you call the police? And they said, well, so many people around turning lights on, I thought somebody else would call. That's last century. Now, this century, we're on a totally different level. Because of that case, I made a decision. I didn't decide right there and then, but it made such an impact on me that I made a decision. If I see somebody who is struggling, who's weaker than me, I am stepping in. I know there are consequences. I am very well aware that for being a good Samaritan, you can get punished. But I made that decision then. And now I just got a chance to take care of people who had amputations. And you already know my experience of going flying the first time when I thought I would die. You know, I didn't have any problems. I had one. And that was my life. I don't know that guy behind me. And he, you know, we're thousands of feet above the air. And there are no doors, you know. And I didn't have any issues. And I kind of, my strange mind put it together. I say, look, if you take a guy or a girl who had amputations and you go off the cliff, their subconscious mind will think, oh, I am going to die. And they're going to forget that they're missing legs for a short period of time. It really how it worked in my head. And, you know, I just thought I'll scare them so much that for a little moment, they will forget about it. And when you're flying, you feel freedom. You're just free. You just, once your brain, you know, shuts off and it does shut off, you enjoy the scenery and you kind of relax. Everybody feels peace at some point in time. But that's how the idea of what I'm doing was born. And that was just the first step, you know, because first step was let's take them flying. Then let's make it a week. Now it's 10 days and they need physical therapy and they need psychological support. And I have a swimming coach and I have a cycling coach. So all these things get added on the way. But the first idea was, let's take somebody who sacrificed so much and scare them so much, they don't even remember that they had a permanent loss and they're not whole. So for a little period of time, when they're in the air, they don't remember. If you go to wingsforheroes.org or from Wings for Heroes on Instagram, it's that video is pinned to the top and you can watch our first, we call him number one. You can see our number one flying. He's a super brave guy, but you see that moment when he is like, wah. He said, all the volunteers said, oh, we found the moment when we scared number one, because, you know, he was a soldier in the assault brigade and we scared him. And I was like, yes.
You're so funny. So are you, can I ask you, are you in the Denver area? Are you in Colorado? Where are you located? So people can kind of have an idea.
Okay, so we are Colorado. We're a public benefit corporation incorporated in Colorado. But I run the mission in Turkey. And the reason I run it in Turkey was because I'm clearly aware of compliance and liability in the United States. And I knew that financially, first, it would take me hundreds of thousands of dollars. But besides that, to get all the permits, insurance, and, you know, to explain. Imagine I have to ask the Department of Defense or whoever, say, VA, can you give me a hero who lost a leg, and I'm going to run off the cliff with them. I don't think anybody would go for that. So I found a company in Turkey who flew people with limited mobility. And I told them, this is my idea. And I said, but I don't have a chair, because we have modifying flying chairs where you can push the people, because you need to run off to get a little bit of speed. And they said, look, this is how we do it, and this is how we're going to do it. So I said, okay, cool. Then I called the governor of a region in Ukraine where I worked before. And the reason I knew him, because his father was one of my employees, and he was the original guy. And, you know, when there are changes in the company, people get laid off. But he was excellent because he knew his work. He did it well. And you didn't really need to explain to this. He was, you know, late 60s. He's an adult. He knows what he's doing. He has a lot of respect. It's all his people. He trained them. So why would I fire him? And the father lost, his wife died, and all the kids are grown. So he has nothing in his life. And those gas stations that he was in charge of was the only thing that kept him alive. And he worked until he died. So our governor kind of, you know, he knew me and he had the appreciation. He was an extreme sports guy. Now he's in the office of the president, I think he's too busy dealing with, you know, what's going on with the war in Ukraine. But one time I was going up the hill, and he raced the quadricycles, professional. And he actually gave me a ride one time to the top of the mountain, and he saw me flying. So, you know, when I told him that's what I do with our heroes, that's what I want to do with them, he said, okay, I understand what you're trying to do. You will get a phone call, and they will find you a guy. And from the moment when I saw that girl and I said, I'm going to do it, to the day that we flew our first hero, it took a year and a half. And our first flight was June 22nd of last year. So it was a really long process. You know, it was a really long process to literally get this off the ground.
Thank you. Thank you for explaining that. Yeah. I mean, I love Colorado. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. So, you know, just a hop, skip and a jump up to Colorado. And I was actually there about a week and a half ago. It's so beautiful. The mountains are beautiful. The drive up is beautiful. I actually got my master's degree in Denver. So that's why I asked about Colorado. I wasn't sure.
I spent, you know, from 2004 till 2015 and until I left to work in Ukraine, Colorado was my home, and Colorado is my, I'd love to come back someday just to give you an idea. Once the mission is flying, I'm taking it to the States in November. And I was in San Diego last October for training, and I went to this famous paragliding site. It's called Torrey Pines Glider Port, which is located right next to Torrey Pines Golf Course. And when I was inside, I was wondering, looking at, you know, at their store and how they're set up, I found that they have a flying chair, modified flying chair. Yes. So you have pilots who are licensed and insured in the United States. Somebody donated the chair. It was sitting in the corner. Nobody was flying it. Right now, there is a lady who has ALS. She is using it. She started a non-for-profit who flies people with Lou Gehrig's and ALS. So it's active. Yes, it's called Adaptive Impact. If you check them out, they are the organization that flies people with ALS in San Diego. So she took the dust off the chair and it's operational. So my goal in November to take it back to the United States, to take it back home. I saw the opportunity where I was. I took advantage of it, and I knew deep down inside that once it's flying, I can go anywhere in the world. Because when you can show people that it's done, they're like, "Yeah, man, let's do it."
Okay,
we want to do it.
Seriously, I could actually talk to you forever, just to be honest, because there's so much. And how do you even try to distill down someone's life just in general? But yours is almost larger than life, which I kind of love. And it's like this movie in itself. I'll just wait for you, you know, to be Clark Kent and take your, and you have the Superman suit. You're like, I'm ready to go. But we do have to get to the meat part of the podcast.
Okay.
So I already know you're looking forward to this. So am I. I would love for you to share either, you know, it can be more than one event, but where you feel like you've witnessed something, you know, magical, miraculous, mysterious, anything you'd like to share.
Oh.
And I also
so many moments and go ahead.
Well, sorry. I was just going to say, and I know there's a story about 9/11 too in there somewhere.
Okay. Let's, since you mentioned it, I think it's appropriate to start with 9/11. My father raised me. He had the saying, punctuality is the privilege of the kings. In other words, you have to be on time. And when somebody drills it into your head since you're a little baby, then that's what and who you become. I don't remember being late in my entire life. Like, I remember seeing my bus and I would run after my bus. And if I don't catch it this stop, I would catch it at the next one. And that day, well, the day before, I met with my friend. We studied together for the CPA exam. And that's an 8 months process where you go every weekend. And he worked for Merrill Lynch right across from me. I was in the World Trade Center and he was in the World Financial Center. And I was waiting for him for a really long time. And his boss kept him for some reason. It just went on for really late. We met already really late. By the time we caught up and we finished, it was like almost morning time. And we slept through, but I decided I'm going to work because I had a lot of things to do. He said, I'm just going to call a day off. I'm not going to work. So he stayed at home. It was a Monday that we met. And then Tuesday, I think it was the mayoral election in New York City. And I went, this is how convenient everything was in New York. From the Bronx, which is up north, you could take a train for 1 hour, the A train, you can switch the train. And then you can take a train underneath the World Trade Center. So the stop is World Trade Center. Then you take an escalator to an elevator, then elevator to another escalator, to another elevator, and then I'm up on the 83rd floor. So technically, you can travel from the very north or the very south of the city and be in your office at the top of the world and never go out. But that day, I decided I'm going to go out and I'm going to get some coffee. And I walked out. And I saw everybody standing like this and lots of sirens and everything. It was just the, our building was the North Tower. It's the one that got hit first. And I look up and I see this light smoke coming. And I was like, I was way up in somewhere in our, because we were in the upper portion of the building. I thought that something burned overnight. And then I crossed the street and the second plane hit the South Tower. And that's when, you know, everything shook, all the ground and people started running away. You know, people are running away, police and firemen running against the crowd into the building. And I thought that it was a successful terrorist attack in terms of before that, they drove vans into the South Tower, but they couldn't detonate them. And I thought that this time they were successful because I couldn't see the plane. I was on the north side and it flew from the south. And as I thought, you know, I went to the New York University, and New York University at that time was the second largest property holder after the Catholic Church in Manhattan. And if you look at the undergraduate Stern School of Business, they're building maybe like 10 stories. But all of those stories, there were no classrooms there. It was research and professors. All the classrooms were down below. You go levels into the base, like underground. And I was like, oh, cool. We have payphones, we have vending machines, we have security. And oh, by the way, we're in the bunker. So I'm walking north towards my school. And on the way, I found out that that about what happened. And the following days, I love the mountains, you know. I came to New York to go to NYU, and I wanted to work in the World Trade Center, but I'm done with both. I'm done with school, and you know the buildings are gone. So I decided I'm going to go and find home somewhere else. And that's where the miracle things started happening all everywhere. So first of all, I went to Colorado and I got an offer to work in California. But in California, if you're working in the trading, you know, the market opens at the same at New York time, not LA time. So in LA, it's 3 hours earlier. So you have to get up in the middle of the night. You have the commute. You have a very different, relaxed culture where in New York it's like really strict. And I didn't really, it didn't work for me. So then I moved back to Colorado. And then I got an offer from a company in Texas. But because my place of work was destroyed in an act of terror, I was classified as a displaced person. An American Red Cross sent me a check for $15,000.
Oh my God.
That was the first one, just like, you know, it's money that you don't have, but you need to survive somehow. And it came out of nowhere. And later on, I don't remember what year it was, but I was already running my business. And it just so happened that the situation was just so difficult that I didn't know how I'm going to make it work. You know, it basically you grow and expand. And if there's a change in cash flow when you're spending everything that you make into reinvesting in your business, you hit a bump on the road, then you have an issue. I mean, you can grow slower and put cash reserves, or you can go all in. My style was go all in. And I remember that day, it was a Memorial Day weekend. And I am standing, I don't know if you ever had that experience when you think that you're finished, you know, you're done, you're out of business. I'm standing outside of Denver and like everything is spinning around me. I see like the buses floating and people are like running somewhere. But it's a surreal experience because everything in me knows that the numbers are not working out. And it's a Memorial Day weekend, and I had some obligations to see people, and I cannot even look in the face of family members because, you know, my business is going to fall apart. And then something inside me says, go check the mail. And I go check the mail. I open my mailbox, I take out the mail, and I look at this and this. And I was like, return address, Texas. I was like, what? Who would send me a mail from Texas? And I open the envelope. And I take out, there is a letter inside and there is a check for $5,000. And I'm reading this letter and it says, hey, Lubim, I know you're going through a difficult time. Here's the check. I don't need a promissory note. Whenever things work out, just mail it back to me. Foy. Foy was the father of my clients. He was a very successful businessman. He wasn't even my client. He was the father of my clients. His son and daughter-in-law were my clients for years, and I was taking care of them. And I was just talking in the conversation, I mentioned something, and the guy came from, he was an orphan, you know, he was in an orphanage, and he picked it up. He was just so zeroed in. He knew that I'm a hardworking guy, and, you know, I led my clients. I had a registered investment advisory firm, 2008, 2009, none of them lost money, and I always did the right thing. You know, I always did the right thing, but it's just an outside events. I just was facing this issue and I didn't know how it worked. And that check just, I didn't even ask, you know.
Wow. I want to go back to the 9/11 experience and just clarify something. So you would have been in the tower except that you wanted a cup of coffee. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, except that I was waiting for my friend. We were supposed to meet. And even though he finished his work really late, I kept that promise. You know, I just met him because we haven't seen each other. We started working and then years go by. We graduated 99. It's 2001. So 2 years, we didn't really have a chance. Just like you starting out, you are at the disposal of the company that you work for. And in New York, they really take advantage of you. You know, you just have to put in the hours. And it was the only time that we could meet.
Wow. I just think about that cup of coffee and that meeting and how it kind of saved your life.
Yes.
kept you safe. And I can't imagine that day. I can't imagine how surreal everything must have seemed, how shocking. Like you said, you already knew about the previous attempt with the vans.
Yes.
I mean, I remember reading about that in the news. I remember reading about that. But just to have it happen in front of you, and it just, things like that, I think for a while, they just don't seem real. It just doesn't, nothing. And again, you were saying the smoke, it looked up so high, it just looked like a little bit of smoke. But then, you started walking away with everyone else, I assume.
I stood around for a little bit. I watched, like, because the crowd ran away and then everybody stopped. You know, because if you look at the footage, when the plane flies from the south, the smoke goes out, the fireball goes out, and it goes back in, and then there is quiet. You know, there is nothing going on because it was one impact. I stood around. I had nightmares because, you know, paper and people fly differently.
Yeah.
That was really sad to see that. For a long time, I was saying, like, look, if I was in that building, I wouldn't jump. Because if you jump, it's 100% that you die.
Yeah.
I would have been waiting that somebody would come in and save me. So the desperation that was inside is just unimaginable.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Do you ever look back at that day and consider or think that some greater force was at work that saved you?
Of course. Of course. And, you know, not just me, because if you, I don't know if people are putting their stories together, but right after, I've heard so many stories that the biggest story is Howard Lutnick. He's right now in our government. He was the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald. It's the company that lost the most people. I think they lost about 600 people. On that day, his son started school and he took his son to school. So he wasn't at work. And then he promised all the employees, the families that survived, that he's going to take care of them. And he was taking care of them. And he had to rehire people right after that. And he did that. But the guy who was best man at my wedding, he had big positions overnight. And I thought he would be at work. But his friend showed up in the new car that he just bought. And he said, hey, man, let's drive into Manhattan in my new car. Even though it's crazy traffic, they drove. They couldn't find parking. When they found parking, they were late. Most people who I knew, people were just late. Kirsten, it's not possible for so many people to be late on that one specific day. And I'm 100% positive. Losing 3,000 people is really sad. You know, there's no words to express, the feelings about what happened. And if you think about the fact that what 100,000 people worked there plus, you think about percentages, it was already getting close to 9 o'clock. Everybody's at work at 9 o'clock in New York City because work starts at 8:30, 9 o'clock. No, 9 o'clock is late. You know, everybody's in. So we had so many people that were late and everyone had their own reason, right? There were all different reasons. It had to be some divine interception to clear out the space, you know, to keep those people saying, look, you, it's not your time. You're going to be late. This guy's going to show up in his new car. You're going to be with your friend. And on and on and on and on. So I'm 100% positive that there was a divine intervention, even on a tragic day like that, that the whole world still remembers. We're almost 25 years later, and a lot of people just were somewhere else, you know?
Yeah, I cannot believe it's been almost 25 years, frankly. I think to myself, where has the time gone, first of all? But it was such an inception point in America's history and so horrifying. I wanted to just remark that, thank you for that answer. And I think about, you know, you getting the $15,000 when you needed it. I think about you getting, you know, opening the mail and getting $5,000 from someone that saw the need. You know, you didn't say anything, but he was keen enough.
Felt it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, are you someone who believes in synchronicity? How do you explain these events?
I've been thinking a lot about promises that we make and break or keep. I don't think people really think about the consequences of breaking a promise. Like, let's say you and I make this time and one of us doesn't show up, but the other person spent time preparing. So they said, no, somebody may have asked you for help. And you said, look, I have a podcast. Somebody asked me to join, you know, I say, we really need you to go and do something right now. I said, look, I have one more call. I cannot do it. I promise you, I will be there tomorrow. So people are getting used to breaking the promises that they make. But if we all break promises, then our life will become practically impossible the way we live right now. If you hire me and you promise to pay me on the 15th, on the 1st and the 15th of every month, and I promise that I'm going to pay my car loan, my home loan, my kids' school, and a lot of obligations. And if employer doesn't follow, then the employee is breaking all the promises down the road, that the chain is endless. And I gave you two examples that were it was money showing up. One more story. I think it was winter of 2013 or 2014. I lived up in the mountains at 9,000 feet on Lake Dillon. And my office was in Denver. So that day, we had this Canadian Express that rolled in. And when Canadian Express rolls in, it's like minus 40. And that's when the lake freezes. It's super cold. It's super cold in the mountains. And I had to drive to Denver and had to come back home. And at that time, I had friends from Japan that were trading in Copper Mountain. They were freestyle skiers training in Copper Mountain. They came before, and we became really good friends. And that year, like, it was a father, and his son was an athlete. And then they had a few more people. But that year, they brought their mom. And that day was the only day that I could see them. If I don't go on that day, I don't see them until the next year. And if they don't come next year, I don't know when I see them. And I came home driving through that cold weather and sitting with clients, and I'm laying on my couch and I'm thinking, I'm so tired. I have to go see them, but I really don't have the energy to drive another 30 minutes to pick them up, to drive them to the restaurant, to drive them back, to come home. You know, I think that day I put on more than 300 miles of driving around, and I was really exhausted. And I said, you know, I promised them that I will take them out. And this is one day I have to go. So I force myself. It's like super cold. I'm driving. We go out, we have dinner, and we're driving back. And my corner of my eye sees a kid outside. And I asked them, did you guys see a kid in the snowbank? They're like, no, Levim, it's impossible. Look, it's the middle of the night. What kid? And I was like, I saw something. So I turn around. I have goosebumps. I turn around and I go and I see this little kid. He's standing in the snowbank. He cannot yell. He cannot move. We pull up. The mom of my friend runs out. She throws a jacket on him. She puts him inside of the car. We turn on the heat. She's rubbing him. He is freezing. He cannot talk. He's frozen. What happened was that he was at the party. The kids were bullying him. He got really mad and he walked out. No jacket, nothing. It was a 10-year-old kid who walked out. He came to the road. He was so cold that he couldn't move and he just stopped. He just stopped in the snowbank on the side of the road. So not only Iris, I know that if we showed up 20 minutes later, he would have been dead. Is that one promise that I made that I'm going to go see my friends and I follow through. And if somebody from above put me in that position, in that situation, outside of so many people who've been around there, to go take my friends out, and on the way back, just in the corner of my eye, in the middle of the road, see a kid standing in the snowbank, and my subconscious mind said, stop. Stop. And I did stop. And they said, no, it's impossible. We don't need to go back. It cannot happen. I went turn around all the way, and we saved the little kid. Or I saved the little kid.
I just had a guest on and he talked about choices. And sometimes we don't really understand the import of the choices we make. And I so appreciate you using the word promises. You know, you had a choice to honor the promise that you'd made, and you decided to, you know, not even comprehending or suspecting the possibility of what was going to happen that night. It's so outside the realm of your imagination.
You can't think that. You cannot imagine, right? It's unimaginable.
But you were in the right, I mean, honestly, it's kind of mind-blowing, in the right place at the right time to do something extraordinary. Once again, and show up for someone who needed it. Once again, you know, not just your friends, but this kid who also couldn't suspect how his evening was going to go. You are kind of like Clark Kent. I'm just going to put it out there. I love that you're laughing, but I'm
I earned it. You know, I earned that one. But I earned that in the small circle of people who were taking care of me.
Honestly, it's just remarkable. And what a profound gift, just in general, because you've been given gifts in your life, right?
Yes.
If you hadn't have stepped out to get that coffee, if your friend and you had not made that plan to meet, you wouldn't have been around to rescue that child who was stuck in the snowbank. And so... Do you ever think maybe I survived that day so that I could help people or bring more beauty to the world or change the world in positive ways, be in the right place at the right time? Do you ever consider that?
I know that. I know that I was chosen. You know, I think people who do missionary work, you've seen what I've done and what I've accomplished in my life. All those things were just preparing me for the next step. And when I have inspiration, people who were there before me, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. Can I share?
Yes. Oh my goodness. Yes.
This winter, I went around the world to see how societies in different countries keep promises to people who protected them at war. And one of my stops was Geneva, Switzerland. And I ended up at the Red Cross Museum, the same Red Cross who sent me a check. And I found out that back in 1859, a young man, a young banker, whose name was Henry Dunant, was traveling for business to Italy. And he arrived to a place called Solferino. I think it was June 25th. On the day when one of the biggest battles was fought, it was 170,000 Austro-Hungarian soldiers against about 150,000 imperial soldiers, which was France and Italy. They met in a place that was called Solferino. And Henry Dunant said that at the end of the day, there were more than 40,000 dead and wounded in that field, and nobody was helping. There was not one person who was helping. So what he did was he organized all the villagers. And at that time, they were mostly women. And they started pulling out the injured and those soldiers who were alive. And he said that they filled the churches. All those people went to churches. And some churches had more than 1,000 people. And after they cleaned up that mess, he went back to Geneva And he wrote a book that is called A Memory of Solferino. You can download it on the internet. That book received such wide attention that he was able to start the Red Cross. 11 months later, after starting the Red Cross, they signed the first Geneva Convention. And now the Geneva Conventions, they stipulate how we're going to treat prisoners of war, how we're going to treat injured soldiers, and how we are going to treat innocent bystanders. But it was for one man who could not look away on that day back in 1859 that now we have a Red Cross. And the Red Cross has more than 11 million volunteers. What I saw in Geneva in museum, I actually have that video. It's on our Instagram, I think. And basically, if you go in the museum, it starts with you entering a room, and that room is filled with cards. They're like these little cards. Excuse me. Little cards where the Red Cross goes in, and if they find that the soldier has died, they write the name on the card, and then a letter goes to a family member. There are more than 6 million cards there. It's endless. It's like this whole room filled from ceiling to wall with cards that went to people, family members who had closure. You know, the worst thing that can happen to anybody is if their loved one is a prisoner of war and or missing in action. And that's one of the patches that they wear. Because these people can never have closure. They suffer their entire life. And if, you know, when things get difficult, because for the first 2 years, I'm running this mission alone, it's self-funded. We received $20 in public support. That's what I raised. But when I think that I cannot go on anymore, I'm thinking, what would happen to humanity on our planet if Henry Dunant looked the way of if he stopped? And then I just keep going.
So I'm going to leave out the word hope, but I just know that you all really love this conversation and meeting Lubim. There's going to be a link in the episode show notes to that incredible Instagram video of the first ever gentleman who took the leap, shall we say, in the program that Lubim has cultivated and curated for those who are suffering the after effects of war. And, you know, those wounds aren't only, as you know, physical, they're also psychological. And I can only imagine that what Lubim is bringing to these gentlemen, to these human beings, is changing their lives for the better and helping them assimilate more readily into society. Honestly, I just sat back during this interview and let Lubim talk because he has something to say, and guess what? He says it, and then he takes action, and he gets it done. And so there'll be a link to his website and to his book so you can buy those to support the work that he's doing. So many times, I actually do think that this world really likes to use us, to capitalize on us, to capitalize on human bodies, on animal bodies, and then throw us away. But there are people out there in the world who are ready to help those that capitalism has forgotten, to help those that war has forgotten, to help those that society has forgotten, and he is one of those people. I just cannot say enough about what an enchanting and powerful human being he is. And I'm just endlessly grateful. Like, I will never be grateful enough, to be honest, that he's in the world. And I guess that's part of the premise of this podcast, that despite the bad news that we see and hear every day, I want to remind you that there are good people out there. There are kind people out there. There are grace-filled people out there, you know, of every stripe, color, and kind who want to make this world a more beautiful place. So yeah, that's part of the mission of this podcast and maybe even the mission of my life. To check out a little bit more about Lubeam, hit on those links. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Lubeam. Honestly, I know that we're all walking through our lives and seeing where the need is. We are seeing those who need help. We are seeing animals that need help. We are seeing land that needs help. We are seeing places in the world that need help. And I guess I'm asking you to figure out a way to take action on that, to stand and hold true for those who don't have a voice. I mean, honestly, I keep talking about building up an army, right? And I don't mean an army that's going to destroy things, but an army that's going to help people, that's going to see the need and step forward, that's going to say, hey, I have an idea. Hey, I have something here that can help. Hey, I know someone who can help. And guess what? I mean, the more that we step forward in our communities, that we step up in the world, we're going to really become a force to be reckoned with. So I guess I'm talking about creating an army of peacemakers, of beauty creators, of those who refuse to back down when they see injustice. Because frankly, in a country, in a world like ours, no one should be going hungry. No one should be without an education. And as well, I am someone who believes that the land and the animals upon it and the air around us, you know, they all deserve an equal voice in how we shape and mold this world. So I'm asking you to be like Lubeam and go out there and show up for those without a voice. You'll have my undying gratitude and you will have Lubeam's undying gratitude. And guess what? You're going to have the world and the earth's undying gratitude as well. All right, I'll see you next week for the very next episode. And until then, lots of love to you, lots of happiness, and hopefully conversations with strangers who ultimately become your friends.
And another of my inspirations is Mother Cabrini. She was an immigrant who came from Italy to the United States. And when she saw the poverty of the Italian immigrants, how they lived, she started building schools, orphanages, hospitals. And when she died, she built 67 total. One lady, one immigrant, but no, I know what it's like being an immigrant. So, you know, when you have people like that, those two have shown me that if we have a chance to do something like this, there's no way. I'm just a guy who could not look away. And later on, I found out the inspiration that helps me going in Henri Dunant and Mother Cabrini. And Mother Cabrini Shrine is an amazing place in outside of Colorado. And actually, I made a little, yeah, they're right outside of Colorado. If you start driving up I-70, don't go on the main highway, go on the side road and you will find her shrine. And I made a video about it and it has almost 1.5 million views on our face. It's on our Facebook page for Wings for Heroes. I pinned it to the top. It just blew up. You know, I have like 1,200 followers and that video has been seen all over the world by almost 1.5 million people. So talk about divine intervention, talk about people, things, events showing up in your life. There is no coincidence. I know for sure that sometimes you think based on everything I know, all my experience and everything we've seen before, it cannot go on. It's the end. But then you wake up and say, wow, it's still going on. And I didn't do anything, right? I was just standing there. I showed up and it happened. So if somebody is ever wondering if there is a divine power above us, like, it will never leave us. And having that faith, I think, is the most important thing. Like, the fact that you don't know something, it shouldn't stop you. And you have a calling that is inside of you and you wanted to help somebody or do something for somebody else and you get going, then that's when you see miracles. You know, that's when you see miracles happening, and they will show up and happen all the time. And I've seen it so many that when you asked me that question, that's why I kind of stopped for a second. I was like, oh, where do we start? But here's where we are. Henry Dunant and Mother Cabrini. And when you're next time in Colorado, check it out. You will really love it. And go up all the way to the top. Or just watch the video on our Wings for Heroes Facebook. It's the first video at the very top. Put together a project on Kickstarter. We started writing a book with the first guy that we flew. To give you a little bit of background, here is our number one who we flew.
Okay.
The guy in the middle.
Okay.
He had a problem with his left leg, the only leg that he has, and he needed an urgent month of physical therapy. Okay. He just completed it and left on June 25th.
Okay.
He was 20 years when he volunteered. He didn't need to go.
Yeah.
He was flying drones first. But he said, you know, I felt like I'm hiding behind the backs of civilians. And for 5 months, the guy kept writing letters saying, I'll transfer me to an assault brigade. He was transferred to assault brigade, and then he lost his leg when he was actually going to save his commander. He said he was within arm's reach. He was the closest guy. And he said, I was like this and I didn't make it. And I asked him, you know, you realize the risk? And he said, yes, if I stayed behind, there was 95% chance that I would come home alive and well. But if you're in assault brigade, you have 95% chance plus of not coming back at all. And I asked him, if you had to do it again, what would you do differently? And he said, I wish they would have accepted my letters earlier and I would do exactly the same thing, because I am supposed to protect people who are civilians. I'm not supposed to be the guy who is behind. I'm supposed to be the guy who's in front. He just turned 23. He's 23 years old, you know? And talk about strength of a kid. And I think that his story needs to be heard. And I'm trying to take my story of how I came to Wings for Heroes. And that's how we met. And that's how I made him the promise. And I saved his only leg. He's a captain of his amputee soccer team. He can play again. You know, he can live a life. And by going to Turkey and socializing and being around people who don't speak his language, he's 100% independent. He goes everywhere. All the volunteers are writing, oh, we cannot find number one where he's like, guys, relax. He goes to the bazaar. He goes to the east side. We have a castle here. He is completely independent. He's like, I don't need anybody. You know, every president has a soldier that is commissioned. They have a soldier who is serving the president. Here they're called Haberci. So there is a Haberci who was with number one, and he's like, I cannot find my president. I cannot find my boss. Where is he? I said, look, this guy is looking for you. And number one says, you know, I have his phone number. He gave me a phone card. My phone is working. When I need him, I will message. Completely independent in a foreign land.
Wow.
So that's the story that I'm writing, and that's what will be in this book. And I think a lot of people will find inspiration and miracles and faith, and, you know, that guy has everything in him.